Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. Find sometimes the body scan technique is a really helpful way to bring awareness more fully in the here and now. But it can also bring in a little bit of sleepiness. And I noticed there was a little bit of whiplash meditation out there tonight. Yeah. You may know of Pema Chodron, who teaches in the Shambhala tradition, is a very popular author, a wonderful, wonderful teacher, wonderful speaker. And she was asked by a reporter years ago, "What got you started meditating?" And she said, "Oh, that's easy. I hated my husband." And I like asking people, what called you to practice? What called you to slow down and start paying attention in new or maybe more subtle ways? And for most, there's some kind of dissatisfaction that kind of called in practice. Sometimes for people, there's some very deep personal struggle they're going through, or sometimes it might be, you know, I always told myself I'd be happy when I made this much money, and now I'm making this much money, I'm not really that happy. There's got to be more. And I think that's really part of the drive of this intention to practice, to see through the dissatisfaction and to see more clearly into the nature of reality. A real cornerstone of really understanding life is that suffering is part of life. This stress, dissatisfaction, unhappiness is part of the human experience. And for some of us, it comes and goes. For some of us, it feels more permanent. But part of the practice, really, at least through this lens of Buddhist psychology, really boils down to two things. It's about suffering and the end of suffering. It's about seeing into the nature of what is it that creates unhappiness, and how can you unwind those knots and increase your capacity for happiness and joy and kindness and compassion and all those wonderful qualities. So tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about addiction, about moving from addiction to wise action. And addiction ranges from the gross to the subtle. It ranges from using substances and engaging in activities to alter your state. And it's as subtle as seeing your habitual thought patterns. I saw a line recently that said that we're not so much addicted to things. What we're really addicted to is escaping reality. I'm not by any means an expert on the topic of addiction, but it does tie into this whole theme of suffering and the end of suffering. And I have the deepest respect for those who work in recovery. I certainly apologize in advance for anything unskillful I might share. But I'd like to talk in this little bit of time we have tonight about how everyone, just as everyone experiences some form of suffering, everyone experiences some form of addiction. We all have our own personal ways of escaping reality. And as Buddhism points out, there's a cause. If you look closely, you can see what it is that creates that impulse to escape reality. And it's possible to be free, that there's a path, there's a way that no matter where you are in your own patterns, to increase your capacity for happiness and joy and freedom. So not far from here, in West Virginia, there's an incredible epidemic of heroin abuse. You probably know that a lot of heroin now is laced with fentanyl, which is a very cheap drug that offers a very immediate and oftentimes a lethal kick. I was reading about it, particularly in The New Yorker. It was a writer who was traveling with the paramedics in West Virginia and writing about observations from what they noticed. And it's amazing to see how a culture adapts. And what they're saying is that because the drugs now are so potentially lethal, that many users are choosing to get high in public. So they'll go to big box stores or malls. So if they pass out, someone will see them and they'll be revived. They're just unbelievably horrific stories. Of one story of the paramedics went to a house and a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old were following instructions from 911, giving their parents CPR. They said that whenever you see, not uncommon just to see a car pulled over to the side of the road with someone slumped over the steering wheel. The oxycodone pills cost $80 and heroin is $10. So those who have gotten hooked on painkillers now are using these cheaper alternatives. And the interesting thing about heroin, which I didn't know, is that it not only numbs physical pain, but it numbs emotional pain as well. And it's amazing that it's so close to where we are right now. And for me, anyway, it's really easy to sort of to see the use of drugs like that as kind of unreal or not here. But in essence, it is about escaping reality, which we all take part in. And so when we look at self-assessment, it's very helpful to look at your own patterns. What do you do to escape reality? Again, it can be very overt to incredibly subtle, from substances all the way to habitual thoughts. The common behavioral addictions are drugs, alcohol, or getting high on something other than drugs or alcohol, gambling, sex, the internet, shopping, video games, plastic surgery, binge eating, engaging in risky behavior. And then there are the subtler ones, sort of the noble ones of work, being addicted to work. And then the subset of emotions, the patterns of anger, judgment, or blame, and the patterns of disassociation, of getting lost in restlessness, inability to settle, kind of pulling the plug on energy where you find yourself spiraling, disconnecting, but spiraling into a depressive state. Or the patterns of doubt being paralleled by fear, by the ruthless self-critic. We have such clever ways of using activities to escape, even the things that are good for us. Exercise, work, creativity, reading, all of them can be ways of escape. A dear friend has really gotten into making cards by hand. Actually, it's become such a passion, but now I'm seeing it's kind of a way that I'm escaping having to work or having to deal with people. So it takes a certain vigilance to notice, when are you disconnecting from the here and now? And when you notice the ways that you disconnect, the ways that you escape reality, it's important to recognize that you're not alone. You're fully, fully human. And of course, as Buddhist psychology points out, those moments, whatever they are for you, the moments where you disconnect from reality to seek some other state, under that lies a cause. The cause of suffering or dissatisfaction or stress, according to Buddhism, is some form of attachment, some form of clinging, and an inability to let go. Recognizing that is really key. And of course, it's a big, in the theme of recovery, you know, that process of recognizing is really critical. And there's a debate, from what I understand, in the recovery community of, you know, do you have to hit bottom before you're really ready to move on? And there are those saying that the substances are so lethal that something has to be done to circumvent so many deaths. But in that same way, we have to be responsible for ourselves. Some heart-wrenching stories. A story I ran across of a woman who noted that her husband was drinking during the day, and that he would go to pick up his son at daycare while intoxicated. And they had many, many arguments over it. Her father-in-law wasn't any help. And she was tortured by, how do I deal with this? So finally she called Al-Anon and reported him to the police when he drove off to get their son in daycare. That's what she had to do to create a healing crisis. I spent some time with a young man who started engaging into kind of recreational drugs and really finding it very, very helpful in his own practice and seeing great insights and so forth, and started pursuing more friendships in that world. And then to discover that the people he was beginning to hang out with, not only were they not happy, but most of their life energy was about finding the next source for their experiences. And someone who realized at some point that her pursuit of relationships, primarily through sexuality as a way to connect and find intimacy, recognizing at some point that it was never satisfying, that it was just perpetuating a cycle of pain. We have to recognize our own patterns. And the sooner we can, the sooner we can begin to look for new possibilities. And so it's very helpful to reflect with whatever your avenues might be. Is it in balance or is it out of balance? There's a checklist I ran across online regarding activities. You know, is what you're doing preventing you from being healthy? Are you doing this more than other people that you know? Is it costing you time at work or with friends? Are you engaging into it even though you know it's not good for you? Has it become your form of stress relief? Do you need to do this in order to have fun? That ruthless self-evaluation is a part of spiritual practice and part of life to really look at, is what I'm engaging in resulting in more wholesome or less wholesome activity? So the interesting thing about non-judging awareness or mindfulness is you become more sensitive to your life. You know, as we say, you know, you feel better. You feel your sadness better, your depression better, as well as your joy and your kindness. But when you recognize you're engaged into a pattern that is not wholesome, that moment of recognition is really, really critical. In neuro-linguistic programming, they say that if you want to make a change in your life, it's relatively simple. That what you need to do is to associate massive pain to not changing and massive pleasure to making the change. So if you're smoking and you want to quit smoking, go to a cancer ward and hang out with lifelong smokers. And that will probably help you to associate pain to not making that change. The Buddha had his moment of awakening, kind of in the archetypal story of the Buddha, when he encountered the four heavenly messengers. As a young man, when he saw a very, very sheltered life, when he saw someone who was sick, and then he saw someone who was old, and then he saw a dead body. And then he saw a renunciate. He saw a monk who seemed joyful, who was living a very, very simple life. And that was his wake-up call to find, what is it beyond this cycle of birth and death? What is it that's beyond sickness, old age, and death? Is there something beyond this? That was part of his wake-up call. And we all have those moments of realization that I can't continue with what I'm doing. When I was in grad school, I was in a relationship with someone who was a very kind and really wonderful person. But it looked like I was going to get locked into a job with the two kids and the picket fence, and I wasn't ready for it. And I read Ram Dass's book, Grist for the Mill. And it was that moment of, I'm going to live a different life, that just sparked something inside of me. And there's something in here, particularly when you do your own assessment of, is what I'm engaging into resulting in more wholesome or less wholesomeness, to reflect on cause and effect. If you don't make a change, what will the result be? If you do make a change, what might that result be? Seeing that can be so helpful. And it's as subtle as habitual addictive thoughts. I was working with someone who found herself unable to stop hating her ex-husband. Her mind just kept cycling through the complaints, the old stories, all of her hurts and all of her disappointments, and he had kind of moved on. And we explored a little bit of cause and effect. And I asked her, if your life continues with this pattern of hatred and bitterness, what will the result be? And I encouraged her to kind of play it out in her mind. And she said, I will be a bitter old woman, not unlike my mother. No one will want to be around me, and I'm going to feel isolated. Then I asked her, well, what would you need in order to change? And for her, it was about the willingness to really feel the hurt that she knew was underneath the anger. Her willingness to explore what it meant to forgive. And mostly, she realized it was about giving herself permission to grieve. And so then we explored if she really did give herself permission to do that, to really feel her feelings, to forgive, to grieve fully. And she were to play that out, what might that be like? And she said, well, it would be a new life. You know, maybe I wouldn't find another life partner, but I would have friends and I could have access to my children again. I could be around my grandchildren again. And she began to see some new possibilities. So for her, that pain and undigested grief, the result of that was simply an addictive thought that she spun back to again and again and again. But quite often, when we use activities or substances as a way to disengage from reality, and we don't see it, and we don't pause and look at it, the consequences can be grave. For her, a life alone as opposed to a life reconnected with her kids and friends and family. And we all have our ways of doing it. For most of my life, it was work. There was a certain satisfaction I got from work, but then I realized at some point that I couldn't stop, that all of my self-worth was tied up in my work, and that I was chronically taking on more than I could possibly do. And what I wasn't willing to feel, truly, had to do with a sense of self-worth or the lack of self-worth. I was very caught in an old pattern of feeling like if I'm not performing all the time, then I'm of no value. It was only when I was able to really slow down and sense what was underneath that chronic anxiety of work that I could begin to feel some new possibilities in my life. So maybe we could do a short little reflection, if you like. You can close your eyes. And you might turn your attention to your breath. And you might like to take a few moments just to sense, is there some particular habit that you have? It might be a substance, it might be an activity, it might be a pattern that for you in some way is a way of disengaging from your life. You might just take a few moments to reflect on something you might like to investigate. And if you can sense a habit or a behavior that is less than wholesome, you might inquire, if this didn't change, and maybe if it became more chronic, how will that play out? And can you imagine that playing out to a place of being at its most extreme? What would that be like? What would that feel like? What would that look like? And if you were to make a change, what would you need in order to cultivate that change? What would you have to feel? And if you could make that change, not perfectly, not all the time, and you were to play that out, what would that look like? What would that feel like? What would that be like? And if you'd like, you can deepen the breath. If you'd like, you can open your eyes or you can remain with them closed. What I find is when you begin to slow down and pay attention and cultivate non-judging awareness, you begin to notice what's between you and feeling free. You begin to notice what's between you and feeling fully alive. And it takes a certain amount of honesty and courage to recognize that. And then even more to really investigate that, to really look into the nature of that. Oftentimes there's an unmet need. There's something that might help you to cultivate a different relationship with that. But it takes effort to shift your relationship to this. And one of the most helpful things, particularly when you are living a life that is committed to being more alive, is recognizing that you're not alone. It's something we're all actively engaging into. And one of the most powerful things is being in community. Particularly being around those people who have a shared commitment to being more awake, being more compassionate. It's about really honoring those wounds. So you may be familiar with the term. In Japanese, it's called a kintsugi. And if you've ever seen the pottery, the Japanese pottery, there'll be a pot with a crack in it. The pot has been damaged or cracked, and they fill in the crack with kind of a combination of lacquer and gold or silver or platinum. So these pieces are really, really beautiful, where the crack is actually becomes a beautiful work of art. It takes the breakage of this piece of pottery and turns it into a beautiful object of art. And the repair, when it's done correctly, is stronger than the original piece of pottery. And so this becomes a very powerful metaphor for spiritual practice. Just to read a little quote here, it says that not only is there no attempt to hide the damage, but the repair is literally illuminated, a kind of physical expression of the spirit of Mushin. Mushin is literally translated as no mind, but it has connotations of fully existing in the moment, of non-attachment and equanimity and compassionate sensitivity. That's a really beautiful metaphor. When you think of the greatest challenges in your life through that lens of kintsugi, how have your challenges made you stronger? How have your challenges delivered to you lessons you could never have gotten any other way? How have your deepest challenges made you a more compassionate person? And this is where, in spiritual practice, the sacred wound becomes the sacred gift. And one of the most amazing elements of recovery work is how, as you move through your recovery, you take the wisdom and compassion you've learned and you put it to service when you sponsor another person. Suddenly, you're working with someone who's had the same struggles you've had, and you are an amazing guide. You're an amazing teacher for others. I was once, actually recently, sitting with a young man who's really, really struggling through really unhealthy patterns. And I could just see, just right around the corner, what an amazing guide and teacher he was going to be for other people. It wasn't quite there yet, but there was that glimmer. In that same way, as you grow in wisdom and compassion, if you've ever met anyone who is struggling currently with something that you struggled with before, your heart automatically opens to them because you know what it's like. The most wise and compassionate people often are the ones who've really suffered and gone through it. So there are heartbreaking stories out there of people who have hit rock bottom, who, you know, had their license suspended, have lost relationships, who've suddenly recognized the harm they've done to their children, to their families, to their relationships, how they've damaged their health or damaged relationships beyond repair. And it's heartbreaking to see the suffering that occurs. And there's an amazing element here as well, which is the possibility and the power of coming more whole. There was a young teacher who was studying with Jack Kornfield as part of his teacher training. Really super bright person who had read all the books and done all the retreats and listened to all the Dharma talks. And she asked him, and she said, "What do I need to do to be a better Dharma teacher?" And Jack looked at her and he said, "You need to suffer more." I have really come to develop just the highest regard for those who've actively worked their recovery. There's a level of honesty and a level of clarity, of compassion, and a sincere desire to help others. And it's the same thing for those I've met who are on a path, on a sincere path, a sincere desire to be, to cultivate greater wisdom and compassion, to be more alive. It takes the same degree of honesty to recognize what's between you and feeling free, and to choose, rather than a way of numbing yourself or disassociating, to actually lean in and look at that. It's the most inspiring thing out there that I know of. It's recognizing that our suffering is a profound teacher. And it's learning that rather than escaping reality, that the real refuge actually is reality. And it's the willingness to explore the brutality of that. And as you know, if you've ever done a residential meditation retreat, they're the most brutal thing you can possibly do. Because it's just you and you for days and days and days. And the same thing with whatever your meditation practice is. It's such a mirror for the mind. You get to see all the ways your mind wants to escape. How it just spins off into blame or externalizing or it goes off into countless, endless variations of fantasy and disassociation. Or you see how your mind just hops right on this little hamster wheel of restlessness and worry without any resolution whatsoever. Or you see your patterns of disassociation, of just wanting to go numb, just not to feel, to unplug. Or you'll see your habits of ruthless self-criticism, of that internalized self-critic that just won't let you off the hook. It is a brutal, brutal, brutal practice. And when we see this pattern, which is inborn for all of us, of wanting to escape reality. There's a story which I've shared before, but it's so poignant. It's the story of this renowned spiritual teacher. Everyone who went to see this teacher was transformed, but no one would talk about it. And he lived in a remote location, so you'd have to hike for 2 days to get to his little hermitage. And then he would meet with you, then you'd have to hike out 2 days. And by the time people had hiked out, on some level they were transformed. So when people would go to see this hermit, he would say, "You can't tell anyone the question I'm going to ask you. But I have one question. What are you not willing to feel?" Answer that question, and you're on your way. There are so many reasons to be scared and terrified about this human journey. So many things can go wrong. There's that horrible quote that says that life is a sexually transmitted disease that is always fatal. It can be bleak. But it's helped to recognize that there is a path, that actually turning toward what you're not willing to feel and actively looking at that is a path that may take you into dark places, but ultimately leads you to a greater sense of wisdom, a greater sense of compassion in your life and for others. So it's really about turning to face your demons, turning to face what's between you and feeling free, and to figure out a way of working with them. And the good news is that there is so much evidence now, just as in that practice, the practice of kintsugi, you know, where you take the crack, you take the broken pottery, and you mend it, that is stronger than it was before. You know, quite often, you know, when you wound your flesh, the scar tissue is actually stronger than the flesh beforehand. That there are certain studies that are saying that even with addiction, that when you begin to explore and engage into wholesome activities, there's actually a growth of gray matter. That the brain actually responds and actually can grow stronger than it was before. Which is very, very exciting stuff. We've really come to see that the gray matter in the brain, certain things will deplete it. Stress, anxiety, addiction, some of the other things they've noted, smoking, media multitasking will deplete your gray matter. But what grows gray matter? Physical activity, yoga, exercise, meditation, food, learning new things, challenging your brain, forces your brain to get active, and lots of growth in the brain. So in essence, life stimulates gray matter. So not only is it an honest assessment of how you escape reality, it's also an honest assessment of what enlivens you, what lights you up, what calls you forward. And to actively explore that. What do you love? What engages you? That is part of what it means to become more whole in your life. So, why don't we close with a short reflection on that? And again, to feel the breath. And just as you have patterns that are learned and inborn, that are about stepping away and escaping reality, you also have within you that which calls you into life. What do you love? What enlivens you? What brings you joy? And if you were to pursue that which most enlivens you, what would that be like? What would that feel like? And if you know of someone who is struggling in their life now, who may be caught in some destructive patterns, you might just take a few moments to hold them in your heart, to wish them ease, to wish them well. And in these final moments, to wish yourself well and anyone who comes into mind. And as you're ready, you can deepen your breath. When you're ready, you can let your eyes open. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I see the tea and cookie cart just went out into the hallway, so watch your craving tendencies there. There is a discussion group happening, which is quite a cool happening thing right across from the men's room. Thank you, as always, for your support for the class. Enjoy your tea and cookies. I'll see you.